This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, a Fed decision, jobs report, and earnings from more than 150 companies. I'm Bob Moon in New York. I'll have those stories.
And I'm Neira Chahich in London. Spaniards head to the polls again this weekend as the nation holds its third general election in 4 years.
I'm Danielle Bokov in Toronto. African swine fever is proving a boon for American pork producers, even as it devastates their overseas competition. But all of that could turn on a dime.
I'm Nathan Hager in Washington, where U.S.-China trade will be back in focus. We'll preview the latest round of talks in Beijing.
And in Asia, some key earnings coming up in the auto market in China. I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with the U.S. economy. It will be a key week for a Fed decision on Wednesday, followed by the jobs report on Friday. For more, we're pleased to welcome Bloomberg Chief U.S. Economist Carl Riccadonna and Bloomberg Economist Yelena Shelechiva. And Carl, let me start with you, the Fed decision. Big question mark?
I think it's Fed indecision at this meeting. There's really not much for them to think about in terms of rate action or policy action at this time. That doesn't mean there's not bigger pictures behind the scenes they're evaluating. So, for instance, they're still wondering about some details about the end of quantitative tightening and what the composition of the balance sheet should look like thereafter, if that should really match the overall composition of Treasury issuance. So that's one thing they're debating. The other that they're contemplating, which I don't expect them to reach a decision on, is their inflation targeting framework and how they have under-delivered or underperformed relative to their objective of 2% for most of this cycle. There's a big Chicago Fed conference coming up in June where they'll be reviewing academic research on this topic. So, again, not reaching a conclusion, but this is something that's happening behind the scenes.
Yelena, is the economy still fluid at this point, or were we seeing the jello set up a little bit?
Absolutely. I think the economy is doing just fine, and the recent data actually telling us that things are improving after some sort of a lull that we observed in the beginning of the first quarter. So, for example, durable goods, new orders are telling us that things are improving in the factory sector, despite some inventory overhang, which really weighed on activity in the beginning of the year. Retail sales are doing much better. We saw a spike in auto sales. So things are improving going into the current quarter.
Carl, is the concern easing? Let me put it that way.
I think the concern is easing, and we'll certainly be watching for some of the commentary around the Fed meeting for confirmation of that from policymakers. They highlighted the weakness at the start of the year, but what was missing, I think, was their characterization that much of that weakness was temporary or transitory, a phrase we heard a lot when Janet Yellen was chair. And that was a way to dismiss soft patches as being something that doesn't really lead to a reshaping of the broader outlook. I think that's going to be a focus in the commentary around this Fed meeting. If they're dismissing the weakness as transitory, that means they could be mulling the possibility of stronger economic performance than what they're projecting in the back half of the year. In my mind, that means that if we're seeing stronger economic performance and maybe even a lower unemployment rate than they're projecting, we could, in fact, see rate hikes start to creep back into the periphery, even though in the markets right now, the sentiment is looking for rate cuts.
Well, since you bring up the unemployment rate, let's talk about the jobs report coming up on Friday. Yelena, are we seeing improvement there?
I think we could see actually a decline in the unemployment rate to what the Fed is currently expecting for the end of this year. So we might see a decline to 3.7% in the unemployment rate just because job gains are so strong, and we might see that happening in this report. So we expect a slightly better number than the consensus, but we are at 210,000. And we think that it's just going to be another strong report with acceleration in wage growth.
210,000, that sounds like a good number to me.
That's a very good number, and that's well in excess of what we would need to see to continue nudging the unemployment rate lower. Typically, to stabilize the unemployment rate, we would need job gains of about 100,000. So we're talking about twice the pace of what would be necessary to stabilize unemployment. So I think Yelena's on to an important notion here that unemployment is going to grind lower over the course of this year, and that's going to be one more surprising element to monetary policymakers.
But what about wage growth, Yelena?
I think we will see some acceleration in this report. We saw a little bit of a tick down in terms of growth in wages in the previous report, but overall trend is for wages to accelerate. Labor market remains very tight, and that will continue to push wages higher. This will have implications for inflationary pressures. So one channel through which we can actually see a pickup in inflation is rental inflation, because wages will push rents higher. We will see that in the CPI data, for example. And we can we also observe some shortages in vacancy rates. That will also push inflation higher. We expect acceleration in inflationary pressures by the year end.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Chief U.S. Economist Carl Riccadonna and Bloomberg Economist Yelena Shelecheva. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, the earnings parade continues on Wall Street with Apple, Alphabet, and a slew of healthcare companies set to report. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. As the stock market hits record highs, we get another batch of earnings on Wall Street. For more, let's bring in Bloomberg Stocks reporter Sarah Poncik and Bloomberg Stock Market columnist Dave Wilson. Sarah, let me start with you. It is going to be a busy week, and finally, we get some healthcare numbers.
We do get some healthcare numbers, and like you said, this is really going to be a doozy of the week. This is the busiest week for earnings season, so it should be an interesting one. Tuesday is really a big day for healthcare. We'll get the likes of Eli Lilly, we'll hear from Merck, we'll hear from Pfizer, and this should be pretty interesting because when you think about healthcare stocks so far this year,
blah,
they've had a really rough time. That's a great way to describe it. Yeah, you look at Eli Lilly stocks, Merck stock, both pretty flat on the year compared with an S&P that is now putting in new record highs. Pfizer's down around 10%. So maybe this will finally present investors some opportunity to focus on the fundamentals, see what these numbers do actually look like instead of just focusing on the talk about Medicare for all. But we have seen evidence recently showing that investors are starting to get back in on healthcare. So if these numbers are good, there is the potential that we do see a bit of a chase.
And Sarah, semiconductors as well.
We do hear from more semis, so we'll hear from the likes of Advanced Micro Devices, and we'll also hear from Qualcomm. And particularly within this earnings season, there has been a very outsized focus on the semiconductors, because just this past week, we heard from Texas Instruments, and they posted pretty strong numbers, but their CEO came out and warned about demand in the chip cycle, saying that it could be weaker for longer than expected. You would think that this is an issue. However, the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index continues to put in new highs. Now, Qualcomm is the number one weighting in the stock. Just this past week, we saw Morgan Stanley come out and upgrade the stock to an overweight, saying that the market really hasn't fully appreciated the new opportunities that were opened up with the recent settlement with Apple. There was a legal dispute going on there for about 2 years. Finally, that's come to an end. So I'm sure we will hear executives potentially comment on that. And same with Advanced Micro Devices. AMD is such a high beta stock. The past two times they reported earnings, we've seen it rise 20%. We've seen it fall 15%. So it'll be an interesting one to keep an eye on.
Well, the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index has clearly been on a run, 49% gain in the space of 4 months.
Wow.
But then you had an interruption in that advance in the past week. We got figures out of one of the chip makers, Xilinx, that really took down not only that particular stock, but also the industry group. I mean, you know, we've heard from Intel now, and it comes down to, are they going to give investors reason for pause? Bear in mind, in the case of Xilinx, that stock was up 64% this year before they reported quarterly results. So you can understand why it took a hit after earnings. And that's true across the group.
Dave, Alphabet, tell me about that.
Well, you know, you're talking about the owner of Google, and I mean, they've been among the beneficiaries of the growth of cloud computing. We saw that with Microsoft's results this past week, you know, how well they were received. So, you know, we'll have to see how Google Cloud stacks up against Microsoft Azure, and let's throw in Amazon Web Services while we're at it, since we did, you know, hear from Amazon the past week too. So, you know, where is the growth coming from for this company, and how well are they doing in this sort of competitive environment? I mean, these are the sort of things you have to look at. You know, the idea that one of, you know, Google's projects, you know, coming up with drones, they finally got certified by U.S. regulators. I mean, that's, you know, the sort of pie in the sky thing that they've been working on.
No pun intended.
No pun taken. But anyway, you know, how does the business look at this point? Because there are all these moonshots, as they like to describe them, that, you know, maybe several years down the line they pay off, and the drones are one of them. But then you have to think, well, how's the search business doing? How's advertising doing? How's cloud computing doing? That's where the focus is going to be when these results come out.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Stocks reporter Sarah Poncik and Bloomberg Stock Market columnist Dave Wilson. Let's head to the commodity space for the week ahead now. For that, we bring in Bloomberg's Danielle Bokov in Toronto. Good day to you, Danielle.
Thanks, Bob. The price of American pork has been surging since African swine fever started sweeping across Asia last year. And with the disease gaining strength, U.S. producers stand to benefit significantly, as long as they can keep the disease at bay. Bloomberg's Michael Hertzer joins me from Chicago. Michael, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
This disease is not transferable to humans, but containing it is really everything. So let's start there. How is it actually spread?
It can spread from pig to pig. Ticks can carry it. It can live in meat and in feed and in other supplies kind of kept on the farm. The virus is very rapidly spreading, so it's not really being contained as far as we can tell at this moment in China.
Even vitamins, I think I read, that can contain it. Is that correct?
That's right.
It's not the first time we've seen these sorts of animal diseases affect global meat supply. There was avian flu, obviously, foot and mouth, mad cow. How does the scope of this one compare?
In the early 2000s, there was a mad cow outbreak in Canada, and through that entire outbreak, there was only, you know, in the low hundreds of cattle that were impacted. So far, there's been at least 1 million pigs that have been put down or died of the virus, and estimates suggest that the number could be as high as 10 million. So it's already one of the worst disease ever to affect kind of global livestock.
It is boosting hog and pork prices in the United States. What's the sense of how long that will last?
It should take 3 to 5 years for China to totally rebuild its herd. In the meantime, people think that China will, A, bring in lots of pork from elsewhere, including the United States and Canada and Europe, and B, increase production of other animals such as poultry. For instance, it takes about 6 months for a hog to reach market weight and then be slaughtered. And for chickens, it could take about 14 weeks. So there's a shorter turnaround on chicken.
There's a knock-on effect, too, from all of this, right, for feed producers, too.
For China, in addition to being the top pork and hog producer, they also are the biggest importer of soybeans, and that's because hogs are fed soybean meal and corn as their primary diet. So with China already bringing in fewer soybeans because of the trade war with the United States, they also think that with less hogs to feed, that they won't need as many soybeans, at least in the next year.
So just to kind of bring it back full circle to this being spread, you know, I've read about some of the efforts taking place at airports. It seems as though an awful lot is riding on keeping this disease out of the United States. In a global world with all of the travel that we see, how difficult is that?
One of the first things that will happen if there's ever an outbreak is importers generally will put a stop to any, you know, shipments coming in to safeguard, extra careful that the disease will not spread. So if there was the disease showing up in North America that could stop what has been just a monumentous flow of pork to China from here.
Michael, thank you very much. That's what we're watching this week in Commodities in Toronto. I'm Danielle Bokov. Bob.
Thanks, Danielle. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, the U.S. and China get set for another round of key trade talks in Beijing. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm Bob Moon in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. We get another key round of trade talks between the U.S. and China. This time the setting is Beijing. Let's get more from Bloomberg Daybreak anchor Nathan Hager in our Bloomberg 99.1 Washington newsroom. Nathan.
Yeah, Bob, a team led by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer will be in China's capital Tuesday. Their goal, to get a draft deal by next month. White House Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow.
We're not there yet. We're not there yet, but we've made a heck of a lot of progress. We've come further, deeper, broader, larger scale than anything in the history of U.S.-China trade. And I think that's a good thing.
And Bloomberg News global trade reporter Andrew Maeda is here with me to preview the upcoming talk. So Kudlow says they're close. How close are they really?
I think they're pretty close, but they've been close for a while, right? That's sort of the paradox. At least they agree on the issues. I mean, we know the big remaining issues are obviously access to China's market. Intellectual property is a big issue. How exactly the deal is going to be enforced. So they've been kind of circling around these major issues for some time, and at this point it's about closing the deal.
Chinese President Xi Jinping had addressed world leaders at the latest Belt and Road conference, where he seemed to address many of the very issues that you just laid out there. How could that color the talks coming up?
I mean, it's certainly a positive sign. That's no question. President Xi has said positive things in the past. He has kind of repeatedly, especially to a global audience, reaffirmed that China is willing to open up, that it's willing to provide more access, that it's willing to not devalue its currency. On the American side, I think that they're probably thinking, okay, well, we've heard this song before, right? Are we going to get a text that we can agree on? But there's no question it's a positive sign.
Now, how motivated is China to make concessions on some of these issues, given some of the positive signs that we've seen of late in the Chinese economy?
Yeah, I mean, I think they probably are under a little less pressure than they were early in the year. They rolled out stimulus, both monetary and fiscal, that has probably stabilized the ill effects of the trade war. So, they're probably a little more willing to stand their ground on some of these issues. For example, on enforcement, for some time there was talk that, you know, there was going to be an American presence in China constantly monitoring this deal. I don't think that's palatable to the Chinese, and I think they're working on something that's a little more flexible.
What kind of flexibility could they be pursuing here?
U.S. officials have talked about, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin has talked about there being offices in both countries, which sort of makes sense, right? I mean, if only the U.S. had an office to monitor this agreement in China, it would sort of be almost like a, you know, neo-imperialist way of approaching it, right? So the idea is that the U.S. might have an office in China to monitor the deal, and there might be Chinese officials here in the U.S. to monitor enforcement on this side.
Now, heading into these talks as well, there had been some speculation or discussion that perhaps the U.S. might make some concessions when it comes to protections on U.S. pharmaceutical products in China. I mean, how big a sticking point could that be, you know, given the kind of influence that the pharmaceutical industry has in this country?
It gets kind of technical, but just to summarize, on biologic drugs, the most innovative and profitable drugs made by Big Pharma, In the U.S. currently, they have 12 years of data protection. And apparently, the U.S. is willing to only demand 8 years in China. So that would be a concession. Is it likely to scupper the deal? Probably not. But I doubt the pharmaceutical industry in the U.S. is going to be too happy about that.
Yeah, and we're starting to hear more voices on the hawkish side, I think you could say, along the lines of Kyle Bass and Steve Bannon now saying, even at this point, these late stages in the negotiations, that President Trump should walk away along the lines of what he did in Hanoi with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. I mean, how big a voice does that side of the spectrum have on these discussions?
I think it's a big factor, but you also have to remember, the 2020 election has essentially already started. The president wants to get reelected. On one hand, he has a pretty solid economy. Unemployment rate is near the lowest it's been in 50 years. Growth is fairly solid. He wants to be seen as one of the main drivers behind that relatively solid recovery. On the other hand, he has gained a lot of mileage by bashing China on the campaign trail. So I think we'll have to see which of those two Donald Trumps wins out.
All right, Andrew, thanks for that preview. That's Bloomberg Global Trade reporter Andrew Maeda, and that's what's happening in the nation's capital, the head of the talks in Beijing. I'm Nathan Hager. You can follow all developments from Washington on Bloomberg Politics, Policy, Power, and Law. It airs weekdays at noon Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. Bob.
Thanks, Nathan. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, we look ahead to Spain's third general election in 4 years. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Let's head to Europe, where Spain is holding another election. For more on the country's political landscape, let's bring in Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchor, Neira Cehich.
Bob, Spanish voters will go to the polls this weekend for the country's third general election in 4 years. Spain's economy has been a source of cheer, even as Germany, France and Italy have floundered. But the risk is that an economic slowdown could happen faster than expected. Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez is seen as a front runner, but the fragmented political landscape means a hung parliament is also a probability. For more on the general election, Madrid bureau chief Charles Penty joins me to discuss. Great to have you with us, Charles. Thank you so much for joining. So I mentioned that Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez is seen as the front runner going into the elections. Tell us more about that.
Yes, Sanchez, the Prime Minister of Spain, he became Prime Minister in June last year when he overthrew Mariano Rajoy. You may remember in a no-confidence vote, he became kind of Spain's surprise Prime Minister. And he was forced to call elections for this weekend because he was he couldn't get a budget passed. But coming out of that moment of weakness, he's actually had a very effective campaign. We certainly see him as a clear front runner, going into these elections. His Socialist Party will certainly be the biggest party in Parliament. But the question really is whether or how he will muster enough seats in Parliament to be able to form a ruling majority. And the way to do that is through building coalition. Spain has now become used, to this mechanism of governing by coalition. In the old days, we saw, two very strong parties, the Socialist Party and the PP, being able to divide power. But, because of the effects of the economic crisis a decade ago here in Spain, and also the Catalan crisis, what we've seen is a splintering of the political landscape, and what we expect to see would be some result, some kind of hung parliament in which Sanchez as the leading candidate will be reaching out to try and form coalition and to be able to govern Spain.
And what would be the implications of that, of a hung parliament for policy then?
Well, it depends obviously how that coalition takes shape. I mean, if, as seems likely, Sanchez emerges as the biggest party and head of the biggest party and has the first shot at trying to form a coalition, then, his natural partner would be to reach out to the anti-establishment party Podemos or to his left politically. So obviously that combination would have certain consequences for policy, Podemos. would seek to have a say in policy, and that would influence Sanchez's thinking as attempts to formulate a government. There is talk of another possible coalition with the centrist party Ciudadanos. I have to say that Ciudadanos has ruled out that possibility, and they are certainly seen as a more likely partner in a possible right-wing coalition. But I mean that is another option. That's another possibility that could unfold based on the events of what happens this weekend.
Right. And talk to us about what that could all mean for the economy. I mean, Spain's unemployment rate, some say, gives campaign fodder to Sanchez's opponents.
Well, the Spanish economy has been doing well. We're in the sixth year of an expansion. As I mentioned earlier, Spain is still coming out of this brutal financial crisis, 2010, 2011, 2012, is recovering strongly. And the government, for example, this year expects growth of 2.2%. It's a solid expansion. We see the economy going forward with plenty of momentum. People will be watching, obviously, for the impact of the election result on the economy, how policy, etc., may shape the economy going forward. But at the moment, I have to say, we don't detect too much nervousness in the markets, for example. Certainly Sanchez, up till now, has not, his socialist government, his socialist minority government has not been a concern for investors, for example.
What should we watch for as the results come in for anything that might move markets?
Well, the big surprise would be a win, for the right, or a result which might lead people to think that a right-wing coalition, would take power in Spain, by which I mean Podemos, Ciudadanos, and this emerging nationalist party, Vox. The main thing that unites them is hostility towards Catalan independence, but, I suppose the three of them also have, very committed to, for example, cutting taxes. Certainly the market might applaud that. I think, mm-hmm. that could be a result which would be a significant surprise for the market.
Madrid Bureau Chief Charles Penty, thank you so much for joining me. I'm Naira Chahich in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thank you, Naira. Let's stay overseas and head to Asia now for a look at what's coming this week. For that, we turn things over to Daybreak Asia anchors Doug Krisner in New York and Brian Curtis in Hong Kong.
Bob, Doug and I thought we'd take a look at the auto market in China as we have some key earnings coming up from Great Wall Motor and Guangzhou Auto. Now, China saw a drop in passenger vehicle sales, particularly in the second half of last year. Still in all, though, auto sales were roughly 28 million for the entire year, and that compares with only 17 million in the United States. Steve Mann, Bloomberg senior auto analyst, joins us for some discussion about the health of the market. Steve, thanks very much for being with us. 28 million sounds like a lot, but in many ways it was a tough year.
Brian, it is a very tough year for automakers, not just in China, but around the world. If you look at the auto industry, typically it is cyclical, but if you look at this year, it's more of a super down cycle for the industry. I think earnings for most of the automakers are going to be down. Below consensus. We just heard Nissan that they're going to miss the full year earnings estimates, consensus estimates, because of this slowdown in the auto industry.
So, Steve, the question then becomes one of capacity and whether or not there is just essentially too much capacity in the auto industry globally.
That's a good question, because the game in the auto industry is a numbers game. The more volume pumped through factories, the lower unit cost for each vehicle. So if you're pumping or if you're producing less vehicles, that unit cost just skyrockets. In the auto industry, it's very asset intensive, capital intensive. So that's why a lot of these costs just rises through the roof when that production drops just a tad bit.
So, Steve, is this down to trade war jitters, or is it more consumer tastes are changing? What is it?
I think in this part of the world, it's more of the geopolitical issues that's happening around the world. In China specifically, I think most of the consumers here have the money in their pockets to buy a new vehicle. It's just they're very hesitant in opening that purse and taking that money out to buy the next vehicle, because there's still a lot of uncertainty about the economy here in China and around the world. You know, you have Brexit in the UK. You do have a potential slowdown, you know, of the U.S. economy. China is obviously, there's fear that the U.S. trade war will actually dent the economy here and hurt earnings for the individual consumers.
In terms of the type of vehicles that really are making their way to market in a major way, are we talking about electric vehicles? Are we talking about hybrid SUVs or hybrid sedans? In China right now, what is kind of dominating not only the market but consumer taste?
Well, the consumer is still gravitating to the traditional, you know, internal combustion gasoline engine vehicles. But you're right, EVs are what we call here new energy vehicles, which also includes hybrids, are growing really fast, and the government policy supports that. So for automakers, it's a really tough year for them. If you look at their cash flow, you know, sales are waning, likely through the second half. But at the same time, they're going to have to spend a lot in developing these new energy vehicles. So if you look at cash flows, not just earning, the cash flows for automakers, it's going to take a huge hit this year.
The government is kind of shying away from really big moves like a major tax cut for autos or something like that. But it has launched some smaller initiatives. Can you walk us through a few?
They have. I think the last initiative in China, auto incentives that was put in place in China, was a tax cut. But it was only very recently in 2015, and it ended in 2018. So a similar type of incentive is not going to drive sales. What the Chinese government has done is indirectly support the auto industry by cutting the manufacturing VAT tax from 16% to 13%. That actually helps cut costs, and hopefully that cost saving drives down prices for the consumer and lift demand.
What about domestic manufacturers in China looking to overseas markets, foreign markets such as the United States?
It's tough right now. If you look at what's happening geopolitically with the U.S.-China trade negotiation, it's really tough because the U.S. and not just the U.S., the Europeans, I think they all want to protect their own industry, the auto industry. It is a important part of the economy that generates not just jobs at the automakers, but it generates jobs for the auto suppliers, insurance companies, through the whole economy. So my opinion is that industry will remain closed for the Chinese automakers at the moment.
Steve, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks very much for joining us. Steve Mann, Bloomberg Senior Auto Analyst and also Director of Research at Bloomberg Intelligence Asia. I'm Brian Curtis here in Hong Kong, along with Doug Krisner in New York. You can catch us every weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 6 a.m. in Hong Kong and 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob?
Thanks, Doug and Brian. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.